Hello, John.
Hi, Tony. It's great to be able to talk over Skype, over the pond. Great big distance between us.
Ah, great. Right. Sorry about that.
Well, no, not a problem. For those listening into this interview eventually, we've been having enormous technical difficulties, so we've decided to go to audio instead of video. So we're going to start this interview all over again. Tony, can you tell us your name, where you live, your organizations, who you are?
Right. Well, my name is Tony Whittaker. I live near a city called Derby, which is more or less right in the middle of UK. And I'm the coordinator for Internet Evangelism Day, and also work with a mission called WEC International. And the our particular part is called Soon Ministries, which is literature outreach mainly for Africa and Asia.
Okay. Now, when I first knew you, it was about 1997. It was a long time ago when you came up with the Web Evangelism Guide, or the Internet Evangelism Guide back then, wasn't it?
Web Evangelism Guide, we called it then, yes. Yeah.
You had one big long page full of hints, wasn't that right?
That's right, yes. It started as an article that I'd shared with a few people by email. You see, we'd done a bit of online evangelism with the Soon papers, so I just wrote some thoughts down and circulated them by email. And then I was using the search engine of those days, the Google of those days, if you like, called InfoSeek. And up popped my article online. Well, I was mightily surprised. And in fact, it had been put online by Doug Lucas of the Brigada Mission Resource team. And so I really worked with Doug and developed that into a longer resource that kept getting updated and grew like Topsy, really. But that became the Web Evangelism Guide.
Now, how many articles are there? Now, the Web Evangelism Guide is just massive. Approximately how many articles do you have on that website at the moment?
Oh, I have no idea. I mean, maybe there's 100 static pages, but then there's several hundred blog posts on the blog as well.
Oh, there's more than that. It must be thousands of pages of... I've never got to the end of it. It's enormous.
I would have to look that one up. I'm not sure.
Okay. Now I'll explain what's happening here. Tony, this is for a course on internet and mobile evangelism. And so you're one of the gurus in this area. You've got the Web Evangelism Guide. You've been around and you've seen and you've heard talk to a lot of people in this area. What are the sort of top three things about internet evangelism that impress you and have made you devote yourself to this area?
I suppose the huge reach right around the world, you know, even into closed countries, that's the something that we see has grown even more, as you found with mobile phones. The fact that somebody that is searching can for the first time actually find answers they're looking for. I mean, if they don't know Christians personally, if they're nowhere near any sort of Christian literature or anything, where would they look? Where does anybody look for anything these days? And that's online. So it's just become the place we look for everything. And if that's the case, then we should have the very best gospel resources we can do to help people right across the spectrum.
Okay. Now, tell us, what is the bridge concept that you've been talking about?
Well, I remember you, John, saying some years ago that probably in any population there's only 2% of the people would count as active seekers after the truth.
Uh-huh.
You know, they would be actively seeking. Now, I mean, such people are well catered for by outreach sites such as powertochange.com. I mean, that's great. So if you're looking online, searching for answers, there is good resources available. If you're in the other 98%, if that's the right figure, you know, if you're the bulk of people are not really searching, but if we can connect with them in myriad other ways, through relationships, through shared interests, then that's the way, I mean, that's how it works offline.
Uh-huh.
We meet people we work with, we meet people we study with, we build relationships, we share things across the relationships. The web is no different. It's perhaps almost a false dichotomy to think of online versus offline. It's just people and connections.
So you're saying there's a false dichotomy between online and offline. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, when I say false, it's that perhaps at one time we would have seen everything in terms of, you know, web evangelism was something separate. That these days, if we're with social networking, I mean, that's been the big change, big games changer. So, I mean, an individual or a church might well be very active in social networking. Yet some of these people would be people that you would hope to meet, and do know, would meet. You know, there's not a sort of a barrier between the two, necessarily.
Okay. So the online person can be, so the in person on the internet, you can get to meet them face-to-face. The person you met face-to-face at the conference, you can follow up online.
Certainly. And in the context of social media and friendships, yes, some of them, not everybody. You still have the wonderful outreach about potential for people in closed countries who are 10,000 miles away. But equally, it's an added bonus to connect with people that you know or are getting to know. A church, for instance, can really build a social network strategy that connects with people in the community.
Okay. Now, you were one of the first people to write about the Gray Matrix. Who's Frank Gray and what's the Gray Matrix?
Right. Well, Frank Gray is the... I forget his exact title, but he's with FEBC Radio.
Uh-huh.
And he's not been the only one to create such a matrix, but he's modified the traditional Engel scale, which is a way of looking at where people are in their spiritual journey. And those at the bottom of the scale, -7, know nothing of the gospel, nothing of God. If you take them up through to Engel's position with 0, that represented a point of decision, and then 1, 2, and 3 represented growth in discipleship. So Frank has made a very good matrix, which is easier to visualize if you look at it as a diagram than try and describe, but he introduces a left and right axis as well of attitude. So on the left-hand side, he has antagonism. On the right-hand side, enthusiasm. And I find it very helpful because nobody's going to move up the scale unless their antagonism is reduced and they have some reason to be starting to feel enthusiastic about finding more.
Okay, now, the internet can do both, really, but one of the things, it can either increase or decrease antagonism. Like when people see this terrible Baptist church that pickets military funerals over here, they see these videos on the internet of what they're doing, that tends to increase antagonism, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yes. As it has been said, the beauty of the internet is that anybody can write anything, and the appalling problem with the internet is that anybody can write anything.
And how can Christians use intelligent communication in cyberspace to decrease the antagonism of people towards the gospel?
Well, by being genuine, by being non-preachy, I think. Certainly by building relationships. I mean, the big opportunity the way everything has changed in the last 3, 4, 5 years has been social networking. Because, you know, if we go back 10, 15 years, really the only way we could be doing online evangelism was to write, say, static web pages, perhaps newsletters, magazine style, which, I mean, you were a pioneer on this, weren't you, John, the magazine?
Yep.
Or if you were really good at thinking on your feet and talking, thinking quickly, then there were chat rooms where people would meet almost at random and discuss all sorts of topics. But that was more or less it. There wasn't a great deal. If you weren't a writer, if you weren't good at thinking on your feet, there was not a lot you could do.
Okay. Now, Hello?
Sorry, yeah. So whereas now everything's changed, anybody that's on Facebook can talk. And they don't need to be a good writer. They don't need to be... they can just build relationships. And I see that I've called it the threefold cord. That's if you put Facebook with Twitter plus video shorts plus mobile phones, those three things have changed everything.
Okay, one by one. Facebook, Twitter, video shorts and mobile phones.
Yes.
So how do they work together as the threefold cord? I actually counted four. Are you putting Facebook and Twitter on the same line?
Twitter together, really.
Yeah.
It's just, it makes a biblical reference. I mean, you can throw in Pinterest and all these others. But, I mean, Facebook is the one that the largest number of people use, a smaller number on Twitter. Yeah, I mean, Facebook, obviously, you can initiate a conversation or sharing somebody else's, but the beauty is that with one click you can drop a video short into your Facebook posting and then say, well, what do you think of this video, or I found this video very helpful, or, you know, initiate a discussion that way. And of course it means knowing where there are good video shorts, and that's where a resource like yeshe.com comes in, because they have curated a whole range of video shorts in several languages by topic. So you can go to their site, choose one, choose something that you think is appropriate, and it's on your Facebook page.
Okay, so that's yeshe.com.
That's right, yes.
So now, video short, how short is a video? Is a short video?
People certainly, research shows that people's attention span is dropping after 3 minutes. If something's longer than 3 minutes, it had better be really, really good. For this sort of random type exposure to, you know, something amusing, funny, whatever it may be, we will watch longer videos, but if we know what's going to be in them, I mean, but... For instance, the TED lectures, which people are familiar with, 15 minutes, 10, 15 minutes. I'm not going to watch one of those in the middle of the day. It's too much of a bite out of the day. I might put it to one side for the evening. But if somebody sends me a funny clip on Facebook or Twitter, 2 minutes, I can spare that. I'll look at it.
Righto. And what do you... What kind of compelling gospel message can be put in 2 or 3 minutes?
It's always the challenge to be brief. But we have a example on TV adverts, and they know how to tell a story with a few words, a few expressions, very good acting. The question is whether you need to do an entire gospel presentation, or whether... In many cases, something that's more like a parable that illuminates one thing, you know, it's more of a conversation starter. But it's amazing what can be told in 3 minutes in the hands of a good creative person.
Have you seen the Falling Plates video?
I have, yes. Now, I mean, that is a gospel presentation in a non-preachy, non-formulaic way.
Uh-huh.
It works with subtitles. I've seen it in, they've been translating it into a number of languages. That seems effective.
Okay. Now, you said Facebook and Twitter to build a friendship network. Into that friendship network, you're putting the short video, the gospel presentation, or in some cases a text article or an ebook. But then you said mobile is the third part of the golden strand here. How does mobile fit in?
Because it's the go-to device that people will be using. If we go to the majority world, it's the only device many of them will ever use. You know, they will use it for everything. They won't own it, or they probably have to pay for internet cafe, but they will have their mobile phone with them. They may not always afford credit, and they may not always have a smartphone, but that's what the majority world is using. And in the West, equally, people are on the bus, on the train, they've got 5 minutes spare. It's the mobile phone that's switched on. They'll just check their emails, their Twitter account, their Facebook. It's this 24/7 thing, which we never had before. It's always on. People, there's the two-screen phenomenon where people were watching television on the big screen and they're Twittering on their little screen and on their phone about their reactions to whatever TV program is on.
Okay, and you see that people are sharing their thoughts on Facebook, in chat rooms, on the internet, on Twitter. Does that give us an insight into people's hearts and minds?
Very frequently, yes, I think it does. I mean, people, you can hide behind a persona, but people are often very honest, certainly with their friends on Twitter and Facebook. They say when they're having a bad day, a good day, when they're ill and there's a problem. And those are opportunities where you can just come alongside people.
And how do you come alongside people? What's a way? Look, some of us Australians, we're very brash and tough. We don't have no social skills whatsoever. So assume you're speaking to an ignorant Australian like me. How do you come alongside someone and share the gospel with them in a polite British kind of way?
Well, I mean, if who's it that said, I cannot remember the quote. I have to find the quote. But you know, the entry to every person's heart is different. You know, there are a million needs and a million personalities. What would be appropriate as God guides you to come alongside somebody and not preach at them?
Okay, so you think preaching at them is a definite turn-off. If I come up on the big sign saying judgment is nigh, you think that's going to turn most people off?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Okay, so what are some of the things you shouldn't do online?
It's I was writing about this only today. It's not so much what we say, but how we say it. It's tone, isn't it? It's, we can say the same. I mean, somebody can say one thing to you in one tone of voice, and you're upset and angry, and somebody else could say almost the same thing with a smile on their face, and you know, they have your best interests at heart, and you're probably laughing about it. Yes, I mean, tone is so much in how we communicate, and even if we're writing words on Facebook, we can sense. I mean, I'm sure.
Yeah,
you can sense where somebody's coming from. Even in a short email, you can tell the sort of their tone and their mood and the sort of person they are.
Okay. Now, just say you're writing to someone. Should you use all caps?
Oh no, that's a no-no. That one, that's always been perceived as very rude.
Okay. Now, there's a lot of people who've coming into the internet for the first time. They're coming from places like Nigeria or India, and these people aren't familiar with our way of, you know, we've been online, you and I have been online for 20 years. So they're not familiar with all these things. So how would you say an amateur communicator, what are some of the things like that if they're going to be a good journalist, you're a journalist, you're a writer, what are some of the principles that they can put into action to be effective online?
Well, I mean, this is a good point you're making, John, because so many of the things that we've learned instinctively over, you know, 15 years, you know, in just terms of, as you said, not using capitals and not appearing to shout online, are, you know, many folks just coming in are 15 years behind that.
Yep.
It may be that there's a need to sort of, I mean, I can remember that there were lots of guides to email etiquette back in the 90s. Now, you can still find those things probably, but the assumption is that everybody's moved on. But you're right, they haven't. The new people are still are at the start.
I got a shrieking abusive email a couple of days ago from someone completely cussing me out. I'd never met the person. He'd read one of my articles, assumed I was a heretic, misread the article, and sent me this really loaded email. Mm. There are people out there that are full of heat. Now, for the students here, when we're online, sometimes it can get fairly, you know, you run into someone who's totally opposed to Christianity, and you have to take that. You have to take the heat. You have to take the angry email or the person posting on your Facebook page something that's rather aggressive. But what are some of your experiences in internet evangelism or stories you've heard from other internet evangelists?
Yes, I don't think I've had particularly many abusive things. There was actually one good friend. Now, he was, I suppose, a little abusive, saying he was an atheist, but I didn't let him wind me up, and we've had many a long chat. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, don't let yourself be wound up. People can be rude, so what? Let them be.
We need to be calm when we're online. We need to build relationships with people online. We need to send them stuff that's relevant to their culture, such as a short video or an article or an ebook that reaches into their world and connects with where they're at. Everyone's got a different gateway. Everyone's got a different way into their world. We need to connect with them culturally. We need to connect with them interest. Now, this bridge thing you talked about before, that was using a person's common interest. Say they were interested in football, you'd build a site around football. They would come in to that, and there'd be a little link off to the side to a Christian testimony of a footballer or something like that. So if the Holy Spirit led them while they were visiting the site that had genuine information about football, they'd be just tucked away in a corner there. Something about a famous football player. Is that the kind of bridge that we're talking about?
Yes, either interests, you know, hobbies, sport, or felt needs, because many people are searching for answers to life problems. They may not be searching for Christian answers to life problems, but they're certainly searching for help with issues they face. And it's true that I think research shows that in any group, probably 3 in 10 people are suffering from a life issue that's more than just the, you know, the little ups and downs of life. You know, it's a bit more serious than that. It may not be major big, but it would be enough to be more than a little niggle. Now, 3 out of 10 is a lot of people across the world.
It is. And how many people are online now, do you think?
We're past the 2 billion, aren't we now, John? Yep. I remember you speaking about going for the 2 billion.
Yep.
Well, we've had the 2 billion in, and we're moving towards the 3 billion.
Yeah, we are. And a lot of the 2 and 3 billion are outside the West, aren't they?
The majority, the vast majority, indeed. They're in China and India and Asia and the Middle East.
And what devices are they using to access the internet?
Well, I mean, even in Japan, I think the majority of internet access is on smartphones. And I even in Africa, I mean, smartphone or even feature phone is going to be the majority use, I think, now.
Okay, so we're moving away from the plugged-in desktop. Like that I'm here, I've got a 21-inch monitor in front of, or 22-inch monitor in front of my nose, and I'm plugged into a router the size of a football, and enough bandwidth to sink the Titanic. But now people are looking at a screen on a smartphone or something like that, and that's the new computer. That's where they're doing all their work.
Increasingly so, I think, yes.
Okay, now what you've been organizing Web Evangelism Day for a number of years now. What is it, up to 8 or 9 years we've had a Web Evangelism Day?
Now 2005 was the first one, so let's do the math. So that's we're coming up to the eighth. Yes,
we're coming up to the eighth Web. Now, who supports you with that? Who backs you up when you organize this massive global event called Web Evangelism Day?
Well, it was initially, to go back to the history a bit, it was through an initiative that the Internet Evangelism Coalition was doing. Now, they're not really functional now, but at that time they'd created a very productive email discussion group. And on that, a number of us were just saying, well, how do you convince the worldwide church that digital media are worth using? And it was a guy in Norway called Anders Bjørvan Torville, and he said, well, you have a focus day, you know, just as other groups have Bible Sunday and this sort of thing. You create a focus day on the basis that Come for Coffee Today is a lot more specific than You Must Drop In Sometime. And it fell to me somehow, because I was already doing the Web Evangelism Guide, to work up a more detailed proposal. And I took it to the Friends at Internet Evangelism Coalition, and it was warmly accepted. And we agreed to do the first one in 2005.
Okay, and so now they're normally around May each year, aren't they?
It's been a bit variable. More often than not, it's been the last Sunday of April. And it all depends whether there's something else that it shouldn't coincide with, or where Easter comes, this sort of thing. So, in fact, this next year, it's the third Sunday of April. If I check correctly, yes, it's the 21st of April this year.
Right. Okay, now... And what does Web Evangelism Day promote?
Well, to encourage churches or individuals just to think around all the options we've been talking about and more. You know, there's the whole question of church websites that are outsider friendly. There's many opportunities for volunteering as mentors with a group such as Power to Change. The whole potential of mobiles, the whole potential of videos. Really, just, if you like, offering them the plate, showing them just what's available, encouraging churches to share it with their members. One thing I would hope to see much more is that churches would appoint a digital advocate, you know, somebody that knows the potential and can share it and train others in using it. You know, just something as simple as how to post a video onto Facebook, for instance, and where to find them.
Right. Okay. That's important to have these advocates who give people simple protection and simple guidance. But a lot of pastors are terrified of the internet. They think that if they'll go out on the internet and their congregation will run into heretics, or they'll run into a lot of pornography, or the kids will end up Satanists. They'll go to a Satanist website or something. Oh, how do you help churches get over the fear of the internet?
I suppose it, in part, by showing them people who are using it effectively. The fact is that if a church doesn't have a website, it's not visible. There was a rather clever blog post the other week, I think, and it was the effect that, nobody told me we'd actually moved the front door of the church. In other words, the front door of the church was now Google. It wasn't the physical wooden door on the building, because if people are looking for a church, if they are looking for help, Google is where they will start.
I expand on that a bit more.
Well, right. Whoever they are, I mean, if a Christian is looking for a church, as I've doubtless done, we've visited a new town, we'll go on Google and have a look at what churches there are. If somebody's moved town, again, that's surely the first thing I'll do. And then if somebody is seeking, looking for help, and if a church is the sort of church that would offer help on even debt counselling, life issues like this, so much the better. And somebody is searching for debt counselling in their town, and the church has got it, then that's great. There's a link made.
I read one statistic that 85% of young people will not even visit a church until they've checked it out online first, because they want to validate anything before they actually go there. They don't want to experiment by walking into the building. They want to know it's going to be good before they get there.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me. I mean, that's... Why would you not want to do that? I mean, that's just that's just normal. Yes.
And so they're not even going to walk into your church. They're never going to visit unless they've got a website to begin with.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. Now, what's the most dreadful church website you've ever seen, or close to it?
Oh dear, I don't know that I can remember, but we're all learning. One thing that still a number of church, well, there are general problems that church websites have, and one of them is to make it all about the building.
Uh-huh.
You know, that on the homepage there's a picture of the building, and there's no faces and no people, and the website is all about a series of meetings in the building.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's okay up to a point, but if a church is a fellowship of people, then the website should be about people. And my experience of going to the website should be connecting with people, learning more about them, feeling that I'm beginning to know them before I've even visited.
That's good. What about things like flashing crosses and Amazing Grace playing at full volume as soon as you visit their website?
If those things are still happening, they're dreadful. I think we've moved away from that largely, one hopes. But yes, the cringe-making church website can still be around, but I think there is some movement.
What are some of the essentials? I've been told put your church address on the church website front page, because people are searching locally. They'll put Baptist plus your zip code. So Baptist 90745 to find a Baptist church here in Carson, California. What are some of the things that have to be right up front to help people connect with the church website?
Well, certainly, that's a very good point. If you put in the footer of every page on the church site your postal address, postcode, phone, then that is what Google will pick up on. And so if somebody's searching for a church in your town, you want to be up near the top.
Uh-huh.
And so you should be testing Google and finding out, where do you come in Google? And if you don't come very high, why not? And make the necessary changes.
Yes, but thinking about that front page, is people, they type into Google, they land at the front page of the church. You've got well optimized there, you've got a well optimized website there. What should be there, like? Do they want a description of, like, is this a family-friendly church? What are the things that need there to be on the front page of a church website to connect with people?
Well, certainly the front of the page, the front page should be an obvious gateway to the rest of the church sites. So, you know, it shouldn't be crammed with information, but it should show where to go to find the things you need. It's very much about tone. I mean, if the church, if it's terribly formal and full of religious jargon, then that's rather off-putting to an outsider or somebody that's not used to it. You know, in obviously every church has to be themselves, but informality, humour, lots of graphics, those are things that will set people at ease.
Yeah, well, one thing I've always thought has to be on the front, but most families going to church want to know if it has a Sunday school, if it has a good children's outreach. And so, you know, you want a picture of the Sunday school in operation and to see different grades if it's a larger church. Now, in the UK, they mightn't have that because the churches are smaller. But over here, it's the quality of the Sunday school that really drives family attendance.
Oh, certainly. Absolutely, yeah. So all the questions that people are likely to ask, you should answer them.
And what are some of those questions?
Well, I mean, for somebody that's disabled, it's, can I get my wheelchair into the church?
Right.
If you don't have a car, is there a bus route? How would I arrive here? Now, one of the things I do urge any church to do with their website, quite apart from the normal testing of its effectiveness, is actually test it with an outsider, or two, or three, and just ask them to tell you honestly, is this, how are they reacting to things? Explain what they're feeling about things is. Is it answering the questions they might have? And then make changes accordingly.
Yes, I think that's good to always have some sort of someone who's a completely unfamiliar user coming into the website. Can they navigate it? Can they get from point A to point B? Is the information that there, what sort of an impression is it creating on someone who's never been to that website before and is not part of the organization?
Yes, I mean, there's the two levels of it. There's just the general usability of any website, because if we've designed a website, we know it, or we think we know it. The new person is very much like visiting a new town, and all the inhabitants know their way around. They don't even need the road signs.
Uh-huh.
Here we are, and you can. There are towns in the UK that are notoriously bad for signage. How do you get from A to B? What would you get to B? What would you find when you got to B? And so it's testing for usability just for how to use the site is also a big key. And the best way to do that, if you don't spend a lot of money, is just get one or two volunteers. They're people that haven't seen the site before. They're people that aren't particularly web savvy. They know how to use a computer. And then you just set them some tasks and say, I want you to go and find a page about X or Y. And I want you to give me a running commentary of what you're doing, why you're doing it, and what you're looking for. And then just make a recording of that as they go along. Record the screen too, so that you can see what was going on in their mind as they found things or didn't find things, why they misunderstood things that you thought were blindingly obvious, why they couldn't even notice things you thought were clear. And then again, redesign and make changes. And really, put doing that for a non-Christian is just an extra level of that, asking for their reactions on, you know, the how churchy it appeared, how welcoming it appeared, you know, commenting at those sort of levels.
So you wouldn't have the church sermon title posted on the front page is something about the doctrine of infralapsarianism or something. You think that'd turn people away?
So it's much more, what's the overall impression? Is it just a building with meetings, or is this a group of people?
Right.
Is this, if this is a group of people who are welcoming and seeking to follow God and would like you to join in with them on that journey, then that's great. I mean, the less jargon, the better on the front page or on any page.
Yep.
If that's the name of your sermon, perhaps it should have been retitled with a a clearer, an easy English title.
Exactly. And I know you're into easy English. You've done a lot of work in that area as well. So I think John Stott used to say the first three rules of preaching were be clear, be clear, and be clear.
Yes, that would resonate with any website, wouldn't it?
So to have absolute clarity as they're going through it, they know where they're going, they feel comfortable, and it points them straight to the church, or if it's an evangelistic website, straight to the gospel. So you're wanting to achieve clarity and help people to feel familiarity, welcome, and related to with the website.
Yes, certainly, absolutely.
Well, Tony, I because of our delays in things, I've got to get on, and I've got another phone call coming, and I've got to then pick up my wife. So I might come back at you with a second shot, but at a later date with a different set of topics. I love your thinking, love what you've done over the years. But we might pull up this interview here. Besides, 40 minutes is enough for a poor student to listen to.
Yeah.
So if you've got a burning topic that you want to share, send me an email and we might do another one at another time.
Oh, well, bless you, John. Thanks so much for talking.
Thank you, Tony. God bless.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.